welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. I am interviewing today the most amicable human being walking the face of the earth. This is Ken Cloak. Welcome, Ken. Ken Cloak is a world-renowned mediator. He's worked for mediation in the areas of politics, international relations, business, education, personal mediations, and divorce mediation. I, of course, met him as a divorce mediator. And Ken, I have to tell you this. This is what I want to share with the audience. To me, you're a Buddha. You are a present-day, life-size, available to me and anybody who wants to talk to you, Buddha. You're the most peaceful person I know, with the most eloquent communication skills and techniques. And this is why I wanted to share you with the audience today, because when you speak to me in a group of mediators, we think we, of course, have figured things out. We're all successful at what we do. But when you start talking about language skills, thought processes, and techniques to truly communicate in a way that will come out to a beneficial and successful conclusion, you nail it. You simply nail it. And so this is what I wanted to share with you. So with all these areas of mediation that you do, where does divorce and marital mediation come in the context of difficult mediations?
Wonderful question. So I think that we can understand that conflicts occur in at least three locations. First, they occur internally inside of us. Second, they occur relationally between us. And third, they occur systemically in the patterns of behavior that get established between people in organizations, in cultures, in nation states, in family systems. And so if we go back to what happens in the beginning in every conflict, there are a series of intense emotional responses that we have to perceived differences. And those occur most powerfully in the family and in couples. And so every conflict has elements of divorce that are a part of it. In every divorce, there are elements of internal conflict that are taking place inside of each person. And there are also systemic conflicts. So the object of this really is to tackle all three. We have a set of skills for helping people figure out where their communications go wrong. Listening skills, reframing skills, brainstorming skills, skills in prioritization, thinking skills, problem-solving skills, consensus-building skills. We also have a set of skills coming out of conflict coaching and psychology for working with internal conflicts, conflicts inside of us, between different parts of ourselves, between different potential futures that we could inhabit. But those skills are not as common for mediators. They're not as deeply understood. They're not as skillfully practiced. And the same goes for systemic conflicts. Every marriage is a system. Every family creates a system. And within couples therapy and within psychology, we have some deep understanding now of how families create systems. Cultures are kinds of systems, and we can understand that every couple creates a kind of culture for responding to conflict. Culture is a way of attributing meaning. And in every conflict, we have to figure out what things mean, what other people mean by what they say and do. And yet, those attributions of meaning are often contested, and people, the other people don't agree with them. So what we want to try to do in divorce mediation and in creating amicable divorce is, first of all, to help individual people with their internal conflicts about what they're doing. Secondly, to facilitate their communication with each other and their problem solving with each other in ways that transform their relationship from one that has been positively intimate and then negatively intimate into one which is now separate and respectful and amicable. And finally, we want to end the family system in a way that isn't painful and destructive, but in a way that gives each person the opportunity to move forward in their lives and learn from those experiences and decide to do things differently, to have a voice in their own culture. Yes, Judith.
So, beautifully said. Now, because I'm also a mediator, I understand what it looks like when people first come in for a mediation and they initiate the very first conversation, which could be very rocky. Do you start teaching these skills and techniques and making them aware of what you just said so they can refine how they communicate going forward?
Absolutely. The very first thing that I have to do, however, is to build a sense of trust and empathy between us. So if I'm too quick off the mark in trying to correct their behavior, they may not accept it at first because they don't feel that I have any understanding of what's going on for them. So I have to gain that understanding. And then the second thing that I have to do is I have to figure out who I need to work with first in pulling back from engagement and trying to figure out how to approach this in a more skillful way. And usually there's one person who may be more ready than the other, but fundamentally, every problem in every marriage has two sides to it. In every family, there are always at least two sides. And the problem can always be reduced in both directions. So if one person, for example, is always on time and the other one is always late, each one of them can approach the other and figure out how to handle that in a way that isn't destructive or combative or adversarial or hostile. And that's sort of the goal. So part of what I do is I look for the breaks in their communication, the place where I know that they're about to go south and the whole conversation is about to self-destruct. And then I point it out to them, find out whether they can see this place, and then work with them to create an alternative conversation. So if we just begin at the very, very beginning, the very first word out of many couples' mouths is the word you. The word you is a pronoun. And we know that if you say the word you about something that is negative, the automatic response of the other person will be defense and counterattack, neither of which are useful in problem solving. What is useful? And the answer is to switch from you to it. That is, separate the person from the problem. Be soft on the person and hard on the problem, as Fisher and Yeri describe in Getting to Yes.
Ken, if I may interrupt one second, full disclosure to the audience, we're on Zoom, and the Zoom mics are so sensitive. Whenever we touch the desk or in front of us, it goes on mic. So you're an animated person, and this is audio only. So just to be sensitive to that.
Thank you.
I don't want this to impact people's ability to listen.
Thank you.
Yes, you is a pronoun. And I learned early on, before I got into mediation, that if I wanted to engage anybody in a compromise conversation, and if I wanted them to understand my particular take on things, I went for the word we. So that was an engaging first person plural pronoun. It's still
very good.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So there's it, there's I, and there's we. If you use the word it, you create the problem as an object. That is, let's discuss timeliness in our appointments with other people. Well, that introduces the we again. The I part is a confession or a request. The confession is, I get upset when you're late and I feel embarrassed because I feel that we put people at a disadvantage or taken advantage of them. And the request is, I would really appreciate it if you could do your best to either not get upset when I am late or to be on time, whatever it may happen to be. And the we is, we need to face this problem together.
See, I love what you just said about I is a confession and a request, because it's so easy for us as mediators to talk to our clients and say, come from the I position. Well, what does that mean to them, come from the I position? And it's very difficult for them to make the transition and understand that I is not demanding, but informative. And therefore sharing, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a prerequisite for authentic relationship. So, for example, in family systems, there are two fundamental forces, the force of individuation and the force of integration. If there's no individuality, there can't really be a successful relationship. And if there is no integration, it's all I and there is nobody else. So what a family system is finding the balance between I and we.
Now, what if you have a couple, this is so typical, where one person has pretty much suffocated their voice, they come in feeling the victim. I don't really know if I can mediate because he or she always has to have it their own way. That's the backdrop of the marriage. How do you handle that?
Well, there are several levels on which it has to be handled. The first relatively superficial level is to empower the person to say what they want. A second, deeper conversation is to try to find out why it is that they gave the other person permission to silence their voice.
Going back to family systems.
Yes.
They were used to that from their own family.
For somebody who is, let's say, domineering and someone else who is submissive, that's a system. It's like sadomasochism. It's like any number of different systems. There are two pieces to it. There's a yin and there's a yang. And that is a contract between the two of them. They have both entered into an agreement to assume those roles. And what is actually happening is that person has just identified the fact that that's no longer a buy-in for them. They're not willing to perform that role anymore. And therefore, the system is now broken. And when that system breaks is when the person who has been submissive all of a sudden says, no, I'm not going to do that.
Which is a shock to the other person.
Totally.
And now that person has to change the way they communicate because it's a whole different system they found themselves in.
Exactly right, Judith. Exactly right.
Interesting. Ken, what do you think the hardest part of divorce mediation is, if there is such a thing, the hardest part?
I would say the hardest part is when people make up something in order to gain an advantage. They tell an untruth, and they become trapped in that untruth, and that untruth becomes damaging to them, to the other person, and to their children. I have recently mediated two cases in which a spouse has been accused of child abuse falsely by the other person. One was a case in which a mother was accused of having abused her teenage sons by their father, who did it on purpose in order to gain custody over the children. And the other was a case where a woman made the accusation against her husband because he had run off with her best friend, who was 10 years younger than her, and she felt completely humiliated by him. And so she accused him of molesting the children. In both of these cases, the courts bought it because they don't have a way of assessing something as subtle as abuse. Sometimes it can take very subtle forms. And in both cases, the children were turned away from the parent, which was extremely damaging, not only to the parent, but if you can imagine the children who grew up believing that their mother or father had abused them, their lives have now been sacrificed. I call this the Medea complex. I made this up because Medea killed her children in order to punish her husband, Jason, for having run away from her and married somebody else.
You know, this brings up another point, and that is our emotions are so raw and so unpredictable in a divorce based on where we come from and where we want to go to, that we really can do things like kill our children.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get involved in this case somehow, some way? And if you didn't, if you had a case like this, how would you unravel this?
Yeah, that is the difficulty, and that's why these are the most difficult things to imagine. The problem is that that emotions have two sides to them. There is actually a side that is highly predictable and a piece that is not predictable. So the piece that is not predictable, for example, in anger, is exactly what level of anger you are going to express. But anger as an emotion is on a scale that stretches all the way from mild irritation to homicidal rage. And you don't know in advance where you're going to come out. That's the part that is unpredictable, because there are, it's considered to be chaotic in the scientific sense, meaning it is sensitively dependent on initial conditions. The part that's predictable is that it is actually logical for people who have been in an intimate relationship where their emotions have become permeable, where boundaries have been dismantled between them, where the heart has been injured in some fundamental way. For them to experience a full range of emotions, from shame to rage to guilt to jealousy, etc. And taking these apart and working with each one of them separately is one of the skills, I think, of divorce mediation. And you would do things differently. Here's an example of a conversation that feels unpredictable, but can have a predictable outcome. In every marriage, people will be arguing with each other, having what you can easily describe as marital conversations or marital arguments, even in the midst of their divorce. I don't know if you have had this experience, but I've had many people in the middle of their divorce refer to each other as honey or sweetheart or darling.
Yes.
What is that? That is the continuation of the marital system. And now something has to happen to break that system. So here's one question that is capable of doing this. While they're having an argument about something he did that he shouldn't have done, I may find a time when it feels appropriate for me to ask, are you ever going to convince him that you're right? And she knows that it will never happen. And she says, no. So I say, give it up. It's over. And that's a moment of realization. You have to pick the right moment when it actually becomes clear. But it is quite clear to her that she will never convince him. And then you turn to him and say, are you ever going to convince her that you're right? And he gets it. And he says, no. So now's the time to stop trying to convince the other person that you're right. It'll never happen.
That just sounds so easy and so brilliant, and I love it, and you're right. And that moment is where you, the mediator, have nowhere else to go. Yeah. Because they haven't allowed you to go anywhere,
yeah.
Correct?
Exactly. And there are thousands of questions like that, thousands and thousands. And of those thousands, we've discovered maybe a handful, a few dozen. Here's another one that is quite nice. I like this one especially. It can take two forms. One is, what would you rather that he had said to you right now instead of what he just said? What would you really want him to say to you? Or my favorite one is, what question would you most like him to ask you right now? And you can feel an enormous space open up in which what you are being asked to do is to go into your heart and find out, as the Sufi poet Rumi says, what your pained heart wants to say. This is a place where you come to the center of longing between two people. This is not about anger. The logic of anger is grief in divorce. And beneath grief is caring or continued love for the other person.
Or you wouldn't be able to grieve.
Hmm?
Or you wouldn't be able to grieve.
You would not have experienced grief if you didn't actually, if you weren't losing the love that you still nurse inside of you.
That's so logical. That's right. Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to just branch off for a second and have you address marital mediation, which is a little different than divorce, because in marital mediation, it's how to get along, how to stay together. But it's what people go to couples counseling for too. What does mediation add to that couples counseling mix?
Yes, great question, Judith. They're really distinct. However, there is a shared arena of expertise. There is a shaded area in which both perform somewhat similarly. So what's different about them is that marital mediation is primarily focused on conflict and conflict resolution and uses mediation skills in order to get to a resolution of some of the sources of marital conflict. Whereas couples therapy looks more deeply into what the emotional dynamics are between the two people. Now, the difficulty is that if we ask the question, what does conflict consist of? One element in that answer has to be the presence of intense emotion. Because every conflict has an emotional component. And if that is the case, mediators have to become skillful in responding to emotion. But we become skillful in a different way. And the way that we become skillful is in a way that's different from psychotherapy, most forms of it, is by turning the emotion in the direction of problem solving. That is, emotions are a very useful way of gaining insight into problems as a whole, to the experience of the problem and what the experience of the problem tells you about its nature. And so it's a very useful tool in problem solving if you can turn it in that direction. But in order to do that, what has to happen is that you first of all have to be able to talk about what is happening inside of you. Just before this call, I was on a call with a couple who have had great difficulty because she is going through a lot of changes as a result of trying to figure out her relationship with her mother, and is going through a lot of intense emotion. And he feels like there's no room for him to talk about what he's experiencing. And he also is going through issues with his mother and needs to talk about them. And they don't know how to do this together. The idea that one can experience a kind of emotional breakdown and the other will hold them and not experience a simultaneous emotional breakdown hasn't yet occurred to them. So that's a little piece. Here's another piece. Here's an example of a marital mediation I did. I met with a couple to try to find a little bit more about them, and we had some conversations about where they get into arguments and what works and what doesn't work in their arguments and how they could fight better with each other. And they came in for the second session, and I said, "How's it been in the last week since we met?" And he says, "Great," and she says, "Awful." Okay? So awful trumps great. So I say to her, "What was awful?" And she says, "Well, just this morning, on our way here, you left a dirty dish in the sink." And he goes, "Oh God, please!" You know, he can't believe it. He rolls his eyes. And she says, "Well, that's just like you to have that attitude." And now they're off and running and arguing with each other. Okay, so what I do is to experience empathy with each of them. But I have to figure out the answer to a question. And the question is this. On the one side, there is an enormous amount of emotion. And on the other side, there's a dirty dish in the sink. And they don't equal each other, obviously. So I have to find out what the emotion is all about. And when that is the case, always assume that the emotion is correct. And what we are looking for is the meaning of the dirty dish in the sink. So I ask her, "What did it mean to you that he left his dirty dish in the sink?" And she said, "It means he doesn't respect me." Okay, now we have a significant emotional response, but we're not done yet. Because there's something in the quality of their voice and the way that they are talking to each other that tells me that there is something more. I don't know this, I intuit it, and I guess, and I ask a question. And my question comes from inside of me, what I would feel if I felt disrespected by him. And so I ask the question, "What does it mean to you that he disrespects you?" And she says, "It means he doesn't love me." And now his mouth drops open and he can't believe that we've gone from the dirty dish to disrespect to he doesn't love her anymore. And so I turn to him because she's made a vulnerable statement and she deserves a respectful answer. So I turn to him and I say, "Is that true? Do you not love her?" Because I have to give him permission to say no, he doesn't love her. And what he says is, "No, I do love her." And I say, "No, don't tell me. Tell her." And so he turns to her and he says, "Honey, I do love you. And I'm sorry I left the dirty dish in the sink." And he starts backing up a mile a minute. Okay, so this is good. this is very helpful, but we're not done yet. We have to go still deeper. Why? Because she had a very powerful reaction to this dirty dish in the sink. Where did that come from? Where would it come from for you? Where would it come from for me? What's a question that I could ask that would get to that? And my question to her is, what is going to happen to the dirty dish in the sink? And she stops for a second and thinks, and she says, I'm going to have to do it. And I say, who says? And she says, I say. And I said, and who told you that that was the right way to do it? And it comes out that this is a part of what she believes her role is in the house. And we can now understand what the disrespect and the not loving her comes from. And that is because she believes that she has to do it and not him. For him to put the dirty dish in the sink is disrespectful to her because it adds to her work. And if he adds to her work and doesn't respect her, he doesn't really love her, right? So we can see quite easily how she got to this place. And now he's mind blown. He can't believe that this is the case. But he sees it for the first time. But now we have to equalize the equation. So I say to him, are there things like this for you, like the dishes that you do around the house that you believe are your responsibility that you've never talked to each other about? And he says, oh, yeah. And there are the things that she does that get in the way of your being able to do that, to perform that role. Oh, yes. Right? So why haven't you ever talked about these things? I ask first, have you ever talked about them? And they say no. And why not? And I think what happens is that the answer comes back. These are things that came out of our families of origin. They come out of our friends, our peers. They're unspoken assumptions. They are the culture of our family. Great. So let's talk about the culture of your family and what you want it to be. And let's identify all the different things that take place around the house. And who's going to do them? And what's the other person going to do? And how's it going to be clearly reciprocal between the two of you so that work is shared and emotions are shared, etc. So that's an example of a case where I think that a marital mediator would do something that a couples counselor might not do. Now, there are a couple of counselors who might do it.
Right.
And some parts of this clearly go into deep emotions within their families of origin. But this is a part of the gray area that I think both fields share.
I agree with you, and there seems to be a focus on more of an analytical approach. Mm-hmm. And an analytical approach and then a balance. Because we are who we are. We all have different living habits, right? We hope that when we get married, our living habits are copacetic. And maybe our little differences are merely nuances of differences and not things that upset the apple cart. And don't we can, at the beginning of our relationships, maybe a little bit more accepting of these nuance of differences, but as we settle in and become married and move forward to build a life together, we kind of want things our way because it's easier. It's what we're familiar with, right?
Yeah.
But it can't be that way because it's marriage.
Exactly. And worse, there's something even worse. We chose them precisely for the things that ultimately bother us.
Yes.
This is really tough. But if you take a look at how amazingly accurate people are in picking someone that they're going to spend their life with without ever having discussed it with the other person, there are hidden assumptions and expectations that are negotiated between them without any words. Who's going to do what? What's the attitude going to be towards this or that or the other thing? And a part of what is going on, I think, is that we are choosing someone who we can, who can help us figure out how to learn and grow and transition out of our family of origin. Someone who represents counter values, things that we need to learn from, yins to our yangs, yangs to our yins. Someone who has strengths where we don't, weaknesses where we have strengths. And that subconscious matching ends up being appropriate for a certain project, which is the project of learning and growth. And then at a certain point, you can't learn anymore or grow anymore with that person.
Ergo, the need for marital mediation, if divorce really is not that go-to position quite yet.
Exactly. So here we have, I think, a range of options that are open to people. And the highest form of conflict resolution is prevention. And what prevents marital conflicts more than anything else, I think, is open, honest, emotionally vulnerable communication with each other, in which you are talking about who you are and what you want and what you love and what you don't love. And the place where this is deepest, the place where it is, where we are most vulnerable, is when it comes to intimacy, especially sexual intimacy. And so one of the first signs of divorce is the disappearance of sexual intimacy. And the reason is because we don't feel emotionally safe to open ourselves and surrender in that way to the other person. Or because something is bothering us. There are a whole series of reasons why this becomes an issue. And here's a place where you really do want to talk to someone who may be expert in this. There are ways in which marital mediators can help people have the courage to talk about things that are important to them. But when it comes to actually reworking the ways that you are intimate with each other, there are people who are specialists in this. And I generally will refer people to those experts. And the same is true with deep psychological issues.
Personality disorders.
Right,
I know. There are Bill Eddy, I interviewed him twice in January. I just love the man. The books are fabulous, as are your books. And we will share those with the audience before we leave. COVID. COVID has changed our lives in so many different ways. For those who are convinced that divorce is the best thing for them to grow and live a healthy life, may not be able to afford two different households right now because the money that they used to live on isn't the same, correct? So yes. How are you handling those people who have to live together? What kind of advice can you give our audience to deal with that reality?
There are a lot of problems that are showing up in my practice as a result of COVID-19. One of them is people who would like to separate but can't afford to. Another is people who would like to separate but are frightened to because of the possibility of contracting COVID-19, especially where someone has a compromised immune system. A third is where the kids are going back and forth between the households, and one parent allows the kids to have play dates with kids who the other parent doesn't really know how quarantined the family is being or how careful or safe they're being. Another is about wanting to take the kids on vacation over the summer. And one parent wants to fly them to New York City, and the other one wants to put them in a camper van and drive them to New York City. And each one is pointing out the dangers of the method that's used by the other person. And meanwhile, the kids feel torn in the middle. Another version of it is blended families in which there are kids from two different parents who come together, and those go to separate parents who also may have blended families, and so the kids are mixing germs all over the place. And then there are the pressures of homeschooling, and usually these are gender influenced. Oftentimes it is women who give up their jobs in order to do this and then can't work and are not bringing in money and become more vulnerable to the men who may have lost their jobs because of layoffs or furloughing at work. So I think that, and there's a last one I want to put in here because I've had two cases in the last 2 months that were involved spousal battering as a result of the increased pressures of being at home in a relationship where you were forced to be with each other in spite of the fact that you're divorcing and it hasn't worked. I've got others where we've successfully overcome that, but here I have two cases where people were arrested, where the partner called the police. One was a man and one was a woman. They were both violent to the other person in front of the children. So I think all of these are difficulties, and what we have to figure out now how to do is to have a conversation that draws them back into a kind of family decision-making process in which we have to reach consensus with each other. Otherwise, the kids come out worse off.
What you said was just so brilliant. I wrote it down. We have to draw them back into a family, quote unquote, family decision-making process where they were before divorce even entered the picture, because you really are logistically, physically, a functioning family by virtue of the fact that you can't leave the house, you can't afford a second environment.
Yes.
Okay, so that sets them up psychologically with a different viewpoint of how to conduct the conversation. Go ahead, Ken.
No, I think this is exactly right. And I just did this with a couple where they have been living separately for years, and now they're facing these problems with each other. And so we reached a series of agreements with each other, which included his agreement not ever to mention vitamins again, because she gives the kids vitamins and he hates the idea of vitamins. And in which he agreed that if she uses the universal timeout signal and says, please stop this conversation in front of the kids, if he doesn't, he has to pull out $100 right then and there and give it to her. Every time he does this, he gives her $100. And we both loved that one. So it's 14 agreements about how they're going to talk about co-parenting with each other. Regular meetings once a week to talk about what is happening with the children. Not about each other, not about you did this and you should have done that. So we actually have a list of things that they're going to do and not do in those meetings that they agree to. This is what I think mediators are really good at.
I do too. And Ken, at the very, very beginning of this conversation, you listed the three aspects of communication. It's internal, it's relational, and it's systemic. In terms of the internal communication and the idea that we're either about to file for divorce or we're in the middle of filing, and here we are in this same household having to deal with each other, do you ever address the need for alone time and special areas where people can go to be by themselves?
Yes. So in the conversation I just had with a couple, the married couple just before this call, he expressed, he had a kind of emotional meltdown. And then she left him and went into her own room and closed the door. So I said to her, how did you communicate to him that you needed some alone time to process what just happened to him? And she said, I went into the room and shut the door. And I said, how do you think he felt when you did that? And she said, he probably felt badly. Was that your intention? No. Is there a way that you could have communicated this to him without just going into the room and shutting the door? And the answer is yes. I could say to him, I just need some alone time right now. Can you give me a half hour? Right? So, yeah. And now we write that down. And that becomes the way they're going to do it in the future. That's a small case.
No, but that, but all of these issues are small issues, unless yeah. it gets to be violence, that really tick people off. And it's yeah. that nonverbal communication that can be so misinterpreted, and you just addressed it. That you went from nonverbal that was offensive, didn't mean to be, to how to handle what your ultimate needs are. Just use a little more verbal communication when you change your behavior.
And the secret is that everything small is connected to something large. And everything large consists of a series of little tiny things that don't look large at all. And so it becomes possible to fix it on both, in both directions. You can work with people conceptually through insight, and you can also take care of the teeny tiny little things one by one that I call microsurgery. And I feel that this is really what I'm doing. I'm doing microsurgery on their relationship. And of course, they have to participate in this and understand it in order to be able to do it themselves.
Yes, they can't be under anesthesia, can they? Okay, so how do you have people prepare for mediation before they come to see you?
I actually don't. My preference is, and if they ask me how they can prepare, sometimes I will give them something they can do. But mostly what I'll ask them to do is to think about the kind of conversation they want to have with each other, the kind of relationship they want to have with each other. And I will sometimes ask that as a very first question. What words would you like to be able to use in 5 years' time to describe the kind of divorce that we are going to begin working on today? And then each person mentions their words. And then I say, do either of you disagree with any of those words? Nobody has ever disagreed. And then question three. Are each of you prepared in this conversation right now to begin living up to those words? And they will say yes. Final question. Do any of us have permission to stop the conversation if we begin moving away from those words? And now we are moving in a completely different track, a completely different direction. And what fundamentally I think people want is to be amicable in their divorces. They don't know how. They have way too many emotions, you know, screaming inside of them that need to get released. And they don't know how to release them except by dumping them on the other person, which of course triggers their emotions that they want to dump right back. And so what we have to try to figure out how to do is to design the conversations that are likely to be successful in helping them be the one they want to be in the divorce, in the process of creating it.
This is so simple, yet so complex. And this is exactly why I call you the Buddha of mediators, because you're able to just zero in on exactly what we need. And it feels so calming when I listen to you talk. And that's where you want your clients to be in a mediation, exactly. Is calm.
Yep.
One of the things that I have discussed on previous episodes of the podcast is the emotional divorce versus the legal divorce. And I can always tell when people have gone through the emotional divorce first, because they're very pleasant to one another. There's no more arguing. They have taken the time from the moment they made the decision to divorce to get it all out. And then that will take a few years sometimes. It's not a few months, but a few years, because you need experiences to test how far along you've gone in the emotional divorce, right? And then when nothing erupts, you're kind of there, and then you can file legally. What do you have to say about that?
There are multiple divorces. So first there's a physical divorce in which they separate. Maybe not first, but there is a physical divorce. There's a mental divorce in which they stop thinking in the same terms as the other person, or stop thinking as a married person. There's an emotional divorce in which they actually reclaim their emotions for themselves. There is a spiritual divorce, which is about reclaiming your life energy from the other person. They no longer have a right to it. And that ultimately requires forgiveness. There is a heart divorce, which is about the ability to be open-hearted to yourself, to somebody new, even to the person that you were once married to. That's tough. And yet, that comes last, I think. There is a divorce in language, in conversations, which is, here's an example of a conversation that doesn't have any right to exist anymore. Where were you last night? Okay, that's gone. That's a divorce in conversations. There's the legal divorce. If we ask the question, what is a marriage? Then what we have to, and there's a very complex answer to that, we have to unravel the marriage in all of those complex ways, which is why it's so difficult. And some of those ways are incredibly painful, because we have grown together beneath the surface, our roots below the soil have become mixed, and to tear them apart is painful. And we feel that pain. Pain is a part of every divorce experience. And there is also if we think of it in terms of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of dealing with death and dying, we go through all of those, and at the end, there is a final piece, which is living the life you want to live. Getting to be the person you couldn't be in your marriage, but now have no problem whatsoever being.
Is the hardest piece of that when you have children and you still have to interact with your now ex-spouse?
Yes.
Maybe your ex-spouse hasn't gotten to that point. Who knows?
And more deeply, your children are part ex-spouse as well as part you. And they're going to be reminding you all the time of the work that you haven't finished yet, until you finish it.
Ken, when people come to you to initiate, we'll just say a divorce mediation, do you spend time at the beginning going through all of this with them and seeing where they are on the spectrum of the emotional divorce, the mental divorce, the spiritual divorce? Do you spend time doing that with them? Or can they come to you one-on-one for you to help prepare them for that, to do a good mediation?
Do it both ways. And sometimes people aren't ready to have that conversation. They don't give permission to do it, in which case I just help them through the part that they're willing and able to do, to work through. That's a matter of where they are in Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages, in part. But what an agreement that you reach in one stage isn't going to hold up in the next stage. And really, it's better not to think of it just as stages, but as aspects of the divorce process, because there isn't a time frame where you jump from one to the other.
And the more aware people are of all of this going on around them, and these stages they're even, or aspects they're even involved in, does it provide clarity and give them then the tools to move forward? They need clarity, don't they?
Yes, in order to move to the next level. But whatever it is that you did at one level that moves you to the next level, whatever that tactic or successful technique was, isn't going to work at the second level.
Why?
And same from the second level to the third. So for example, if there are two kids who are fighting, the first thing that you do is you separate them. Well, separation is successful in stopping the fighting, but it's not going to help them negotiate an agreement.
I see.
To come together.
I see.
And you can come together and talk about the issues. That's not going to help you with the emotions. You have to have a different kind of conversation to deal with the emotions. And so it goes at each level.
So I love the fact that people are now aware that they can choose mediation as a route to divorce, but they don't really know what it is. This conversation was so helpful in that regard. We are ending our episode now and our talk. I want people to be able to contact you. Would you please share that with them?
They can go to www.kencloke.com. That's C-L-O-K-E.
And thank www.kencloke.com. And don't thank me, Ken, please. I thank you for coming on this show. I, again, have learned more than I did before we started this conversation. So you've helped me exponentially. I've taken lots of notes.
It's a pleasure, Judith, to speak.
And would you be open to coming back in the future and continuing this?
Love to.
I absolutely appreciate it. So thank you again, Ken, and to our audience. Thank you so much for listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. And you can reach me for any thoughts you have, any topics you would like me to tackle. My email address is Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com. Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com. I will talk to you next episode. Thank you so much, everybody.